Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. I am continuing through the tour of Erik Erikson's 8-stage model for development by reviewing how I use the first 5 stages in therapy with children. In this episode, I'm going to review stage 2, which runs from approximately 18 months to 2 years. And Erikson states this stage is about autonomy versus shame. Earlier, I explained that Anna Freud's straightforward method of assessment of children's progress in therapy is to determine if they are developing to typical norms for their age. As a mental health therapist, this immediately brings up the question, okay then, what are typical norms for development? There are a variety of ways to do this assessment, and in order to do it, you need to be familiar with some of the models. As I've mentioned, I typically use Erik Erikson's 8-stage model because that is the one that is easiest for me to remember. And I should say, too, the other major reason I like it is that it includes development all the way through the end of life. And I reviewed the adult stages of development in episodes 5 and 6. Again, here we are in stage 2, and it would still be normal to wonder how mental therapy can support children at this stage. And in the way I work, I do not work independently with children in the first 2 stages. But instead, I have sessions with caregivers included. Humans are still in need of others at this point. Well, as humans, we always need others throughout our whole life. But at these age ranges, this 18 months to 2 year time frame, we literally cannot function without the support of a caregiver. We require help with basic things like food and shelter. And what is more difficult to see at this stage, but perhaps intuitive, is that the growing nervous system for children needs the support of adult nervous systems to learn how to function on its own. So, as a mental health therapist, I want to learn as much as possible about the child and the family environment in order to be of best assistance. So, what are we hoping to see in this stage of development? One of my favorite concepts from this stage comes from Dr. Margaret Mahler, an Austrian-American child psychoanalyst and pediatrician, and she called it rapprochement. It is a French word, which I admit is part of the reason I like it. Almost everything sounds better in French, wouldn't you agree? In English, we might say rapprochement, but I prefer the original term, which is rapprochement. And it's part of Dr. Mahler's larger theory about separation and individuation during child development. This is another great theory, developmental model, that I often reference as well. And this is one of those times. The idea of the rapprochement phase, which she defined as 15 to 24 months, so it's inside of Erikson's stage 2, is the idea of going back and forth, as in approaching, leaving, and reapproaching. The child is really learning how to move independently now, and the caregiver is losing the ability to physically control their movements. So now it is the relationship between them that keeps them connected. One of my supervisors suggested imagining a thread between the child and their caregiver. And you want to observe what happens when that thread gets stretched out between them, how far it can stretch, and who initiates the tightening of the thread or bringing the people back closer together. I'll say more in a minute about how I observe this. Another thing I am also curious about at this stage is the eye contact between the child and their caregiver, as that can non-verbally give me a sense of their bond. As I discussed in episodes 7, 10, and 11, the way eye contact is made through a social group can tell you a lot about the comfort and safety felt in that group, and whom the group members look to for this support helps me understand who up to this point has been providing it. In this case, if the child senses something new or concerning, they are going to look around for support by making eye contact with someone whom they feel can make sense of this unexpected environment. So where and how they look tells me a lot about their ability to maintain their emotions of maybe surprise, shock, concern, or fear. And it also displays how they non-verbally ask for support in doing that from their caregiver and those around them. And how the caregiver responds to these nonverbal petitions, and by petitions here I mostly mean glances from the child, also provides some information about the bond between the caregiver and the child. Ideally, when coming to the office for the first time, you would want to see the child be a bit apprehensive at first. After all, you are a stranger, and this is related to the stranger anxiety discussed in the last episode. And your office is a strange place. So you would be able to see the child check in via eye contact when you are first introduced. For me, I usually look first at the caregiver, wait for them to return my gaze, and then I look at the child. I do this intentionally because it helps alleviate anxiety for the child to be able to first observe the caregiver endorsing me today. In other words, the caregiver is kind of appraising me. This is the first time we've met as well. And they are endorsing my involvement in the family if they appear calm as the session begins. Or at least they're showing the child that they're expecting this to happen by coming to the office today. In other words, if the caregiver feels comfortable meeting me, more than likely, this will increase the child's confidence in meeting me. So I address the caregiver first, and then I attempt to make brief eye contact with the child. I do this briefly, and then I return my gaze to the caregiver. At this stage, and for all of the child stages, it is important to treat the caregiver as the decision maker. And you can do this non-verbally by addressing, as in speaking to them or looking at them, first. It is hard because the child is your patient officially, and children are super cute. But the best thing for your patient is for you to have a strong and respectful relationship with their caregiver. And making eye contact in this way is one step I take to start laying the foundation for this respectful and trusting relationship between me and the caregiver in that first intake session. So with the two things I am most interested in, which is how this pair moves together and how they make eye contact together, I need to set up the office to be able to observe these things. This means blankets or soft cushions on the floor with different sets of toys around the room. I want to prioritize safety, but also leave open space for the child to move as they gain comfort and confidence to do so. In other words, I want to make sure that there's plenty of space for that rapprochement to occur, where the child can move out, explore a few things, and move back. Nearly inevitably, a few things will happen that I want to be watching for. The child will likely move to the toys, and there will either be an unexpected noise, or the child will fall down, or maybe drop a toy. Typically, the child is going to check in if one of these things happen. The eye contact would likely move quickly from the child to their caregiver, and then the caregiver may check in with me. I think of it as like an imaginary discussion where maybe there is an unexpected noise in the office or the dropped toy sounds like it may have broken. So the child looks at their caregiver kind of like, uh-oh, was that okay? And the caregiver looks at them with a, I think so, glance, and then looks at me, was that okay? Again, all imaginary, but something like this is what I hope to see, because all of us then are having a shared experience. We all heard the noise, and now we are jointly trying to make sense of it. The child is resourcing or referencing their caregiver first, which means they have confidence they will receive a reliable response from them. And then the caregiver resources me. Since it is my office, this is an appropriate expectation. We keep sitting and the child usually continues playing or may come back closer to check in physically, not just with eye contact. So I continue to learn more as I watch what happens in the transitions back and forth. I may discuss more interventions in a later podcast, but for now, a specific recommendation I would like to share is something I was taught and continues to work well for me. That is, when you're working with children and you either want to intervene or even just explain something, you want to use as many words as they are old. It doesn't make sense at first, so let me say it again. Your statements to the child are only going to be as long as the age of the child. So at this stage, you are barely saying anything, as in 1 to 2 words. And that is because they don't understand many words yet, especially from a new person. So your phrases to children in therapy include only as many words as the child is old. Let me give you another example. In my training, I learned how to support children aged 5 to 7 by doing group therapy. And our check-in for that group was thumbs up and thumbs down for last week, which is approximately 5 to 7 words. It was an invitation to share highlights and lowlights from the previous week. So you want to pick words most children would understand, which are rarely phrases learned in grad school. So it helps to kind of work them out ahead of time or take time to practice them. So coming back to this stage, one of my favorite ways to intervene is to highlight the rapprochement movements. It is a subtle way to begin inviting everyone to notice the transitions and to encourage communication across that invisible thread that is connecting the child and their caregiver. So if the child moves to the edge of the thread, in other words, they are across the room, and they look back to check in with eye contact, I usually make a statement something like, "You're over there." The first statement is a bit longer to help the caregiver know what I'm meaning. Then I shorten to something like, "There," and "Here," each time the child moves back and forth across the room. Just one word each time they do something helps them tie that phrase to their action and lets them know that myself and their caregiver are paying attention. So, how does Erickson's ideas of this stage being about the conflict between autonomy and shame apply to all these developing capabilities? Well, one of the major milestones of this stage is toilet training, and the child is experiencing all kinds of newfound independence. They can go places away from caregivers, and this invokes all kinds of new responses from the caregivers, and they are encouraged to start toileting independently. All of these things can be kind of difficult to do, especially at first. So to me, the statement here from Erickson is about how the child incorporates these experiences. That is, do they feel autonomy over things inside their range of control? Or do they feel shame about them? Shame is a difficult emotion because at this stage, the child is still getting used to the idea that they are separate from all the other people in their life. Shame is all-encompassing at this age. Like, there's no separation from it. So to me, Erickson is talking about the difference between a dose of confidence in these newfound capabilities or a crippling shame that thwarts the child's ability to learn these new skills. And so Why are we thinking about these stages if we really don't work much as mental health therapists directly with children in these stages? Well, the thinking is that problems at earlier stages will cause concerns in later stages. So we need to know what is expected at this stage in order to identify it if it is still showing up as a concern in a later stage. For example, if I hear someone call themselves a bad kid, that would draw my attention to learning more about how this stage went for them. If that were to happen, I might consider supporting the integration of good and bad and helping the person consider a third way of thinking, maybe Winnicott's idea of being good enough, or letting there be some space between the extremes of good and bad to help them integrate both sides of that and realize that mostly real life is somewhere in the middle. Or maybe the child is having difficulty going from place to place, like home to school and back again. In which case, one might do specific interventions with rapprochement in mind. Sometimes children beyond this stage, for example, want to play hide and seek. If that happens for me, I see that as an opportunity to reinforce my bond with them by playing along and displaying curiosity and yet knowing where they are and how to find them. Even for older patients, if I sense there are still things to be worked out from this stage, I really focus on transitions and I apply extra effort to support the person, maybe, for example, having a specific way that we start and end therapy sessions. These are among some of the ways these stages show up both at the ages they are and in later stages. And I look forward to continuing the conversation. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.